The first kina, shavas suru meni, shima'uni achrai. Shavas means that it stopped. Everything stopped. So what stopped? What exactly stopped? What's not there anymore? So I noticed something interesting, which is that on Tisha B'Av, we focus on the key component is kinos and not slichos. Kinos and not slichos, right? A key component of the Yom Kippur fast day, on fast days in general, is always slichos. The exception to the rule is Tisha B'Av, where you say kinos until midday, while slichos are left out. The concept of a kina is mentioned in Yirmiyahu, and the Haftorah that we just read mentioned the concept of a kina. The Gemara in Tanis 38 points out that Tisha B'Av is a morning of fasting and mourn, is a day of mourning and fasting. Meaning, while all the four major fast days, the four national fast days, are connected to the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash in some way, it's only Tisha B'Av that's actually marking the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Right? That's a difference. Meaning, take even for example, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, right? Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, Moshe breaks the luchos when Bnei Yisrael worships the golden calf. It was a terrible tragedy, but the Jews were forgiven afterwards. On Tisha B'Av, the Jews adopted the report of the Meraglim. The generation was no longer allowed to enter into Israel. So that event led to a punishment that was not revoked, that was not repealed. Chet Egel got a second luchos. On the night of Tisha B'Av, you say Eicha and a few kinos, we said last night, and most of the kinos are for the day when there is no specific Eicha reading. A lot of the kinos focus on the theme of Eicha, to bring home some of the themes that we said of Eicha itself. And the fact that this is correct, that Tisha B'Av is a kina day because of what it's commemorating, versus the other fast days, which are a slicha day, that idea could be proven from the fact that you look at the difference between the same kina or slicha that's set on both, and you see the difference. Meaning, on Yom Kippur, we have a slicha called Eila Eskara. On Tisha B'Av, we have Arze Halavonim, right? So the 10 martyrs. They're on both times. They're on both days, but there's a huge difference. Huge difference. The Slicha Eila Eskara keeps coming back to like a chorus in the song. Right? Eila Eskara keeps repeating over and over. It's called a refrain. While the Kina Arze Levonon does not. It doesn't have that. It says Chatanu Tzureinu Slachlanu Yotzreinu, stresses on Slichas that we ask Hashem to forgive us, forgive us. The Kina has none of that over here. It has none of that. Slichas are usually introduced by the Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim and a Vidui. Both of those are not there by a Kina. Both there are not there from a Kina. So the idea is, I gave a shiur on this subject before Mincha Shabbos afternoon. The idea is that the Slicha hopes to bring about Tshuva. The Kina, it's just everything stopped. There's nothing left. The concept is there's mamish, nothing left. Everything has just fallen apart. Everything has just gone to waste. And that's the concept of a shavas. That's the concept that the Slicha is talking about, of everything just lied to waste. I thought there was a particular image this year that I thought would be a strong image in terms of something to conjure up the emotions of the kinas. And that was the constant image we've seen this year of the desecration of headstones in American Jewish cemeteries. This year, in American Jewish cemeteries, 1,322 headstones have been desecrated. We're entering into a time period where there's like an inverse proportion, meaning no matter how much you understand the president to be a friend of Israel, it's irrelevant. It really is irrelevant, and sometimes the reaction is the opposite reaction. And the constant, this year, listen to this, as we know as a Jewish institution, as a school, this last year, the amount of bomb threats to Jewish institutions nationally, right, nationally was 11. That was last year. 11 last year. This year, 75 so far, 75 bomb threats against Jewish institutions. The notion that Jews have reached a golden age. You know, everyone says there was a golden age of Spain. When the Jews lived in Spain, their mamish was a golden age of Spain. Well, most people don't realize that when Jews have a golden age, it's not like a golden age like everybody else. Even while the Jews have a golden age, which meant a renaissance of poetry in Spain and Piske Halacha in Spain, scholarship, all of it was happening at the same time in Spain. The Jewish business of anti-Semitism had still continued. It was still going on. And I think in the same way that we think we've entered into a perfect period in the history of Judaism, but on the contrary, you know, you're going to look back in the history books and see, yes, this was a time of prolific writing. Thousands of Sfarim had been produced and yeshivas have been built up. But it's not going to make sense when you look at all the records of the pictures that we're going to have of desecrated cemeteries, of homes broken into, of bomb threats, and all the numbers of an America that's free. An America that's free, that's democratic, it's maybe the greatest place Jews have ever lived in history. And it's shocking to think that there is never a time period where the Jew can just be. There's never a time period where a Jew could just be. And it's always something. And that, I think, is the Shavas. Shavas is the idea that we'll have it'll be quiet now. Now it'll be good for the Jews. Now it'll be peaceful for the Jews. Rav Soloveitchik said the kina starts with the word Shavas. Why? Because the word Shavas is a great word. It indicates suddenness. Right? It's like you're running before Shabbos. You have time. You have 3 hours. And all of a sudden you realize, before you know it, everything caught up so quickly, and now it's 7:22, and bam, everything has to just stop. Everything just stops. That's what Shabbos is. Everything all of a sudden stops. And it's almost the opposite idea here, that the Shabbos is used because all of a sudden this suddenness, everything just suddenly fell apart. You could come up in your mind with 3 to 4 simple moves by which everything ends for the Jews in America. You could map it out in your head. All it needs is 3 to 4 simple moves, and everything turns rapidly for Jews in America. No matter how you understand, no matter which way, your direction you're looking from. And the Pasuk says, Uvayom Hashvil Shavas, meaning that Yom Hashvi Shavas, that on the seventh day, God rested, that God stopped work the exact moment Shabbos began. And the idea here is the same. Despite all the warnings that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed, all the prophecies, over and over, the prophets are screaming, stop, we gotta stop. Everything just happened by surprise. Everything was just happened by surprise. Everything was in all its glory before the Beis HaMikdash went down, and it quickly deteriorated for nothing. And it's a message to the Jew. One, we don't like talking about the rest of the year, and I never talk about it the rest of the year, is that everything that we have great going for us could all end in a heartbeat. And a Jew cannot live with that hubris of thinking it's all just going to be there. I saw a passage here in this book, Jew in the Modern World. It's got thousands of passages from different people writing about Jews, non-Jews writing about Jews particularly. Heinrich von Tritschke wrote in 1880, he wrote an essay called A Word About Our Jewry. He says, we have to demand from our Jewish fellow citizens is simple. They become Germans, regard themselves simply and justly as Germans, without prejudice to their old sacred past, which all of us hold in reverence. We don't want them to lose that. There were many great German Jews. It would be a sin to forget the great number of Jews, baptized and unbaptized, Felix Mendelssohn, Rieser, and others, not to mention the ones living in Germany. But they must pledge their allegiance to Germany first. The greatest danger, however, is the unjust influence of the Jews in our press and in businesses. It's unbelievable. The first half talks about how great the Jews are. We can't forget the great Jews of our great Germany, the contributions they have made. So in 1880, it was very easy, very simple move, a great move.
Start by praising the great Jews that you love, the ones who are willing to accept the state and move on. Celebrate those Jews, and then the next three pages criticize these Jews for what they do. They stick together. They grow their businesses together. They have conversations about contempt for goyim. And slowly the intellectual elite starts writing these articles. Give yourself a few years later, and Adolf Hitler is born. You have 1898. You did the accusation of the Dreyfus Affair, and literally 4 to 5 steps, and we're on one of the worst train rides in Jewish history. And that's all it takes, is Shavas. That's what the Kina, I believe, is really about. Shavas suremeni shimuni acharai, sechi yomaos esimuni be'adrei chaver sarkos mishkan. The next kina is kina zayin, echa atzta va'apcha. How could you, rush this wrath? The word echa, so there's two ways of translating echa. Echa means how. So it could mean, the word how has two possibilities. How could be, how are we going to get to the park? How are we going to schlep the drinks? Or how could be just the word how, like just how did this? And that's mamish the intent of the word echa, is this how did this get like this? How did this happen? It's just a statement of shock, of how. Rav Soloveitchik felt that this is a time of, since this is a time of mourning, and it's very hard for us who are a little distanced from the Churban Beis Hamikdash to arrive at a place of mourning, of avelus. And Rav Soloveitchik made the following point, which was very much in the way he thought about the world, is that you cannot arrive at the proper emotional place unless you're thinking in terms of halachic terms. Unless you break it down into its halachic terms, it's very hard to get to where you need to get to. The halacha informs what should be our psychological state when dealing with the day, when dealing with Tisha B'Av. He said you cannot get a religious experience, a Jewish religious experience, without utilizing the materials of halacha. It's a very important point that the Rav made, that everybody wants a religious, a transcendental, a spiritual experience. The Rav said you cannot get there without the path of halacha. You can't philosophize about Judaism, speak about what it means to the universe, without having the halacha at your fingertips. So the Rav did something fascinating. He looked at the concepts of avelus and applied it very directly to how we understand what we're doing on Tisha B'Av. What's the notion of avelus? So, you have different Torah commandments that deal with emotions we're supposed to feel. Vahafta l'recha kamocha, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. The Ten Commandments, lo sachma, don't covet. V'samachta b'chagecha, al tisnachicha b'levavecha, don't hate your brother in your heart, right? Ahavta mesager, love the stranger. So, here's the question. How can one be commanded on an emotion? Ibn Ezra asks that multiple times, every time an emotion comes up. So, how do you command someone on emotion? So the Ibn Ezra gives a famous mashal. He says the mashal is of an Ama Aretz, a peasant who's an Ama Aretz. Okay, you have a peasant who's an Ama Aretz. And he says the peasant Ama Aretz will never want to fall in love with the daughter of the king, the princess. Why? He knows he's got no shot. He knows he's a schlepper. He knows there's not even a shaychus. So because there's not even a shaychus, he won't even allow his heart to achieve such a thing. Says the Ibn Ezra, what you see from that simple mashal is that our emotions are actually guided by our mental state. We can control our emotions. They're within our possibility, our realm of control. You desire only that which is possible. What is impossible is not desired. Right? If it's impossible, it's not desired. So the Ibn Ezra is telling you there's a way to control your emotions if you adopt the proper hashkafa. How you look at the world, like just like the pauper looks at the world and says, this princess is out of my range, That affects his emotions. Your way of looking at the world will impact your emotional state. Now let's apply that here. Says Rav Soloveitchik, a Jew has to know how to have the proper hashkafa of Tisha B'Av so he can modulate what it is that he is supposed to feel, what it is that he's supposed to go through at this time, what that's supposed to happen. So, for example, when someone passes Chas V'Shalom, the initial pain results in crying, fear, a breakdown. Says the Rav, Halacha wants you to be human and feel that initial sign of protest, that it can't be true, it can't happen, a complaint, a nausea, like you're sick, and confusion. Hashem is saying, I want the person suffering to act like a human being. I don't want him to suppress his humanity in order to please me. You're not supposed to say, the moment you hear about a death, you know what? I trust in Hashem and I'm not going to feel any pain. You're not supposed to act that way. Yes, you say a Baruch Dayan Emes on bad news, but Hashem expects that you're going to break down. It's expected. You're supposed to tear your clothes in frustrating anger. You stop observing mitzvos for a little bit because your whole personality is absorbed in the despair of what you just lost. Right? And Onan is not allowed to do particular mitzvos. You're supposed to cry out and shout. You're supposed to act like a human being. A Jew doesn't say, I'm stoic, I don't react, because this is the will of God. Hashem says, that's not the dinim of Avelis. That's incorrect. That's an improper hashkafa. That's not how a Jew responds. The Mishnah talks about Avel, who has not buried his dead. He's potter from Kriyashma and all positive mitzvahs in the Torah. First Mishnah in Brachas, third parak. Rashi says, potter, why? Because a person who is osik b'mitzvah is potter from a mitzvah. You're osik in the mitzvah of kfura, you're exempt from the other mitzvah. Tosfos over there, quoting Rav Bun of the Yerushalmi, says no. That's not the reason. It's not because of osik b'mitzvah potter min a mitzvah. But rather, you know why? Because the Torah tells you that you should remember Yemei Tseischa Me'eretz Mitzrayim Kol Yemei Chayecha. You remember when you left Mitzrayim all the days of your life. Meaning, there are days Yemei, there are days that when you are concerned with life, that's when you remember the mitzvahs. Not days when you are concerned with the dead. Unbelievable. Everyone says the reason why you're exempt from mitzvahs on the day of the death is because Onan is busy with the burial plans, so osik b'mitzvah potter min a mitzvah. Tosfos says no. There's a relaxation of your ability to focus on mitzvahs when you're dealing with the dying, not when you're dealing with the living. And that means that the mourner is relieved from the obligation of certain mitzvahs because he's incapable of performing them at those moments. Right? You lost your own sense of dignity. The focus of your personality has been lost. You're like the comparison the Chazal make, you're like a cheresh shota v'katan, who are all putter from mitzvahs. So, that's what Tosfos is saying when he says you're putter at that moment. That the bitterness, the grief, that your pain is itself a Jewish value. We don't quash that. We don't get rid of that. We don't ignore it. But you have to figure it out and know when to apply it and when it doesn't apply it. So halacha has two stages by Avelus. Rabbi Karp at Shalashudis alluded to this concept. He said first is the concept of meso mutal lefanav, when the dead is lying before you. That's what you call the aninus, from the time of death until the burial. Then at burial begins what's called the shiva. Right? Begins the shiva, the week-long period that goes into shloshim, and then the yud beis chodesh for one's parents. And they're what do you call transitions from depression, bitter, to then a higher consciousness of what that person meant to you in their life. Now let's apply this to Tisha B'Av in a brilliant way that the Rav applied, which brings a whole new understanding of what the Avelus of Tisha B'Av is about and to us nowadays. The Gemara in Yevamos Mem Gimel Amid Beis makes a chilek between Avelus Chadasha, old Avelus, and Avelus Yeshana, new Avelus. There's new and old Avelus. Avelus Chadasha is when a death or disaster strikes a family or an individual. It's spontaneous. Sometimes you couldn't even plan for it. And even when you know somebody was dying, it's still unbelievable when that catastrophe hits. And it's a response. It's not an artificial response. It's a direct emotional response to something that just happened. Avelus Yeshana is the second category. That's due to a historic disaster that took place 1900 years ago. There's no spontaneous reaction that comes up. It's 2017. Nothing transpired right now that necessarily justifies that grief, but rather it's a recollection of things that happened many, many years ago. So here Judaism introduces a very strange kind of memory, a very unique memory. The writer Henry Bergson in Matter and Memory described this type of memory that Jews have when he wrote that this type of memory is not a memory that you feel and touch, but it's a memory that's worked upon and learned the way that Jews review and learn their subjects. That's how it comes up. So you have this other type of Avelus, Avelus Yeshana. Many mitzvahs are based on that. For example, at the Pesach Seder, a person is chayev adam liras esatzmo kilos yotzim mitzrayim. That's that's a sort of a past memory. You're going back far. When you read the Torah, you're not just learning, right? I remember once I went to go see the Amshinover Rebbe. The Amshinover was like, it was laning. It was like 3 a.m. and he was laning. And they were laning the Makos, they were laning the Parsha of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and you could see Amshinover, thank you. The Amshinover Rebbe, whose beard is split in half, it's an eerie appearance. So his beard split in half, and all of a sudden, as they were reading the Makos, he started jumping back from fright. And you could tell it was as though, it was like he was there. So that's this other memory. On Shavuos, we read the Aseres HaDibros. That's not just a limud, but you're recreating Matan Torah. That's why you do it. That's why people get up when you read the Aseres HaDibros. The Rambam writes in a Tshuvas HaRambam, Lama Kamim, why do they get up? So why are they supposed to be standing? At the end of the day, the Kedusha of the Aseres HaDibros is no more Kaddush, says the Rambam, than the Parsha that speaks of Timna, the Pilegesh of Eliphaz. That's a great line of the Rambam. You hear that? The Kedusha of the Ten Commandments, when you read the Torah, is no more special than the Kedusha of the Pasuk about Eliphaz's concubine, his Pilegesh. So what's the answer? Says the Rambam, you're not standing up because this Limud Torah is more special than the other one, but you're recreating an experience of Maimed Har Sinai. You're going back to that moment. So that's this type of memory of Chayav Adam Liras Esatzmo Kilo Yatzim Mitzrayim in every generation. This is a different kind of it's recollection. Meaning, I'll say the difference. When someone dies suddenly, Avelus Chadasha is not a recollection memory. It's a pain of right now. Avelus Yeshana, Tisha B'Av, and so on, is a memory of the past. So in terms of historical, 1900 years later, it's distant, it's far. But something amazing happens with the Jewish people. 1900 years later, a gap. If we would have been given Uganda, a spot in Africa to build a Jewish homeland, I doubt the Jews would have been so committed and dedicated to it. You know, there's a great essay. We should have a series on this here. Maybe after we're done with our Supreme Court series. Rav Kook wrote an essay that many people don't know about because it's tucked away in the middle of one of his other svarim. The essay is called Hador, The Generation. It's an essay where Rav Kook attempted to bring together, to write, It was written for the religious and for the secular. It was written for the religious to understand that that the secular Israeli is not really secular. And it was written for the secular Israeli to appreciate that the religious Jew is not really rejecting everything you stand for. You both are really fighting for the same thing, you just don't have the same way to say it. And Rav Kook writes in there, he says to the religious Jew, he says, you think the secular Israeli is doing this because it's just some other piece of earth and the secular Israeli wants something to fight for and work for? He goes, that's not why he's doing this. Had he had a place in Africa or somewhere else in the world, the secular Israeli never would have given up his life in the way he's given it now. He never would have sacrificed his family to malaria and the other diseases that were there in the uncultivated homeland of the Jewish people. He said the secular Israeli is motivated by a deep longing of Kedusha that he cannot describe, that's buried inside of him. That's what we're talking about here. There's a historical recollection that exists deep within the Jew that cannot, at times, cannot be expressed a proper way, and a gap of centuries cannot destroy it. A gap of so many years will not eliminate it. Think of some of our heroes. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rachel. To us, they're not like ancient heroes, right? They're heroes to us because what they did matters to us now, right? There is a phrase that goes, Ha'avar ayin, the past is no more, Va'atid adayin, the future has not yet come, Va'ahoveh keheref ayin, and the present passes quickly, is fleeting. But for the Jew, it's wrong. It's not correct. The past isn't gone. It's still here. The future is not only anticipated, but it's already here. The future geula is in our hands. And the past and the present connects to the future. That's how a Jew views time. A Jewish view of time is a totally different chefza. It's why, by the way, all the nations, according to the Gemara, start from Tishrei. All the kings, meaning from whatever their first month is. Jews use Nisan. They use mitzvos and their history as the beginning of a calculation of dates. History and timeline. It all comes wrapped up together. A time consciousness. Tisha B'Av, said the Rav, would be a ludicrous institution if we did not have the Jewish concept of time. Why? He says, look at the Kinos. The Kinos says, B'Leil Zeh, on this night my temple was destroyed. On this night? It's 1900 years ago. What do you mean on this night? Says the Rav, according to Judaism, there's no gap between the two. There's no space. Maral writes this. It's called the cycle of Jewish time. When you hit a time period on the Jewish calendar, let's say Pesach, you're not commemorating Passover. You're hitting that same spot on the timeline. That's why you see these things in the Midrashim and you're like, what does this mean? Avram was Lushi Ugos Matzos. He was making matzos because that's the time that it was Pesach. But it wasn't Pesach yet. What are you making matzos before it's Pesach? So this is the answer. The answer is the Jewish concept of time is not that we eat the matzos because it's Pesach. Pesach happened with the matzos because that's the date. On the Jewish calendar, it's one line. That's when that geula happens every single day each year. Says Rav Soloveitchik, Tisha B'Av night, it is Baleil Zeh. This is the day. There's not a past, there's not a future, there's not a present. They all wrap up in one moment. They all wrap up in one moment. And that's what this Avelus Yeshana is all about. This historical Avelus is all about. Avelus Chadasha in this Chakira is that sudden feeling. I don't have to commemorate anything. I just suddenly feel affected by the person who passed. But Avelus Yeshana goes the other way. I need to go back in time. I need to look at the history. I need to recreate the history. And suddenly I'm back there. Once Rav Soloveitchik laid out, it's, by the way, it's brisker. It's very brisker. It's a chakira. There's two types of Avelus. Avelus Yeshana and Avelus Chedasha. A brisker then has to define what's the difference between those two types of Avelus. One is a result to a sudden emotion. The other is a one that you have to recreate historically in order to get back there. Once Rav Soloveitchik has that Chakira set up, the Nafkaminas are beautiful. Now let's look at Tisha B'Av. The Raman, the Shulchan Aruch or Achayim, says that you begin mourning before Tisha B'Av on Shiva Asar B'Tamuz. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, says that it begins on Rosh Chodesh Av. So what does that mean? Is Rav Yosef Karo saying that Bein HaMitzarim, the 3 weeks, are not a halachic concept? So the truth is, the Gemara does not mention Bein HaMitzarim, the 3 weeks, at all. The Medrash refers to it, right? That Kol Rodfei Sigucha Bein HaMitzarim, that all those who pursue her will chase her Bein HaMitzarim. Those are the days between 17th of Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, says the Medrash Eicha Rabbah. The Yerushalmi, the end of Tanis, says that the walls of Yerushalayim in the time of the first base of Migdash and 9th of Tammuz in the second base of Migdash was when it was destroyed. So what is this 3 weeks period? Listen to this Hagdara, it's magnificent. During these 3 weeks, we stop saying the regular Haftorahs, which are part of the regular Torah reading. Usually the Haftorah matches your Torah reading. The themes continue. But during these 3 weeks, we read what's called the three Shlosha de Paranusa, the three Haftorahs of tragedy, of destruction. That's the Inyana Diyoma. What does that mean? It means that the Avelus of these 3 weeks have halachically transformed the day. That's Rav Soloveitchik's Yisod. It has to have a halachic representation, or else you're going to have no shaychus to it. What's the halachic representation? The fact that the Haftorahs have now changed. That's one. That's one. So the halacha says now we got to start feeling something different. Something has to now begin to change. And that awakens the 3 weeks before, where you begin to change the Haftorah. You begin to change the Haftorah. It's, and says Rav Soloveitchik, between Yud Zayin B'Tamuz and Rosh Chodesh Av, that's the time period where you're starting to think. You're starting to remember. You're opening up your memory books. Let me start remembering what happened all those years ago. That's it. That's what happens from that time. Then comes Rosh Chodesh Av, and now the Avelus becomes visible with your body. You understand what's happening here? You're trying to transform your experience. See, when someone dies, you don't need any transformation. It happens right away. But when somebody isn't dying, but rather it's an avelus of history, you need to first, says Rav Soloveitchik, go back in time. It affects your haftorahs, and now we're ready for it to affect us emotionally. Now it's going to start kicking in. So then comes Rosh Chodesh Av. And that's when we start avoiding, when Rosh Chodesh Av says, Misha nichnas av matim besimcha, we lessen our simcha. And that's when we restrict our deals, our business deals, our building, our planting, our marriages, our engagement. According to everyone, during the week, Shvuah Shechalbo, it's aser to cut your hair, wash your clothes, so on and so forth. So on and so forth. Why, when Rosh Chodesh Av came, it said Mematin B'Simcha, while Shvuah Shechalbo, it says Aser Lirchotz, it's forbidden. When Av began, you lessen. When the week comes in, it's forbidden. The words are changing. Says Rav Soloveitchik again. You're getting closer and closer to the emotional experience of the day. At first, you ought to lessen. Why? Because you're going to need to do more things to bring it to your heart. But as you get closer, suddenly at that point, you can absolutely not do it. You cannot do it because you need to be feeling right now the Avelus. You need to be feeling at that moment the Avelus. Take Shvuah Shechalbo, the week during which Tisha B'Av falls, says Rav Soloveitchik, listen to his Agdara, that's the Shloshim. Shvuah Shechalbo is the Shloshim. That's the 30 days. You can't cut your hair. You can't press your clothes. right? And it's different. There's an Isser of Kibbutz laundry, Maisa Umatan, the same type of business, Erisin, right? Getting engaged, washing your clothes and business, that's allowed beforehand, right? But it's Asur the Shvu Shechalbo, because that's the Shloshim. That's the Shloshim. So you're going the reverse. It's an unbelievable idea. You're going the reverse. By a normal Avelos, the transition's the other way. You feel the death, Mesa Mutalafonov, Shiva, Shloshim, Yud Beis Chodesh. Rav Soloveitchik says, it's the other way. Right? It's the other way. You're moving in a reverse direction when it comes to this type of Avelos. This type of Avelos. Whatever we do on Tisha B'Av, as we get closer, are things, are dinim of Hesech Hadas, where we don't want you to take your mind off the Avelos. Someone asked me about watching movies last night. There's no Isser of movies. The Yesod is a Yesod of Hesech Hadas. You don't take your mind off the mourning. You don't take your mind off the tragedy. Doing things which can I take my mind... It's almost the difference between Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. If someone's not feeling well on Yom Kippur and they're not going to make it through the fast, there's a concept of Itzumo Shel Yom Mechaper. The day itself will atone, and there's a power to fasting on this day that will bring you kapara. So you know what you do? You tell somebody, go to sleep. Go to sleep. It's almost as if on Tisha B'Av, checking yourself out is not the proper option. One has to feel the churban on this day. One has to feel the tragedy on this day. And to say I'm going to distract myself with X or Y is antithetical to exactly what we're trying to achieve as you go through the Isurim of Tisha B'Av. The Isurim of Tisha B'Av itself. The Nihuge Avelus, the actions of Avelus itself that we're in right now, which is why we're sitting on the floor, versus the feeling of the Avelus, the Kiyam in the lave, what you're supposed to experience on Tisha B'Av itself. So that's what we're trying to achieve over here. Many of us lost the opportunity of the proper Hashkafah for the 3 weeks. We lost thinking about what Rosh Chodesh Av means. We lost thinking about the 9 days. We wasted that moment. We didn't think too much about it. But here we are in Tisha B'Av, and we try our best to recreate what it means to be in Avelus. Eicha otzta v'apcha la'abed b'yad adomim. Emunecha v'lo zacharta. We're up to Kina Ches. E'ade ad chuga shemayim. If I'd only be able to go up to... My Kina should be able to go up to heaven. I've told you before that I went this year to Abu Dhabi. I became friendly with a guy, a sheikh. His name is Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. He's an American-born guy from Milwaukee. He's considered maybe the leading scholar in the Western world for Islam. And, you know, we've gone back and forth, questions to each other about this and that. And I want to read to you what he wrote to me. This is coming by one of the leading Islamic scholars in the world. Our community, meaning Muslim, his, is in denial about certain aspects within our community. And it's preventing people from hearing the truth. Because once you say that violence has nothing to do with Islam, you just lost all those people out there who you could have reached. Once you admit that we have a problem, then you could deal with it. This is something I told the Saudi government immediately after 9/11. I told them we have to admit we have a serious problem. My question was, how did they take it? They didn't. They just changed the subject in that meeting. Because denial, it's a river in Egypt, but it's not a river in Egypt. You hear that? You know the famous joke, denial's a river in Egypt? It's a river in Egypt, but it's not a river in Egypt. So we're in a state of denial. We're in a state of denial about how deep this goes. And one of the problems with our religion and the Jewish religion. Now watch this. This was such an insightful thought. See, The Jewish religion and the pre-modern Christian religion have stuff in their books that would be real problems in the modern world. If all of it was lived out right now, it would be a real problem in the modern world. And Islam has that same stuff in their books too, that if you lived it out, would be a problem in the modern world. So what's different about Islam? Says this Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, the difference is the Muslims have incorporated all of it into politics. It became part of the political leadership. The political leadership adopted all of that. See, in Israel, you have an idea of separation of shul and state. You have a distinction between the two. We have batei dinim, which carry out some limited action, but the government operates under its own pretext, under its own concepts. Right now, we're not at the madrega, we're fulfilling the things that are there, that are spoken about, of how a Sanhedrin works. Of the stuff you learn at the beginning of Daf Yomi of Sanhedrin, of Chi of Misa, and things like that, and war, milchamas, many of the milchamas that are spoken about. We don't have those same dinim and constructs nowadays. Says this Hamza Yusuf, he says, the problem is, the Muslims live with it every day. They're perpetuating those behaviors nowadays. And he goes, no one is willing to listen. He said, I tried once to put up a post where I talked about we need to wake up. I got a call from Yasir Qadi, one of the most respected Muslims in the world, who called me and said and wrote on Facebook, Muslim leaders should rise up and unite. Stop dividing us. Stop scapegoating the Muslim community. So anyone who even tries to speak up to talk about this problem in Islam is going to be shut down, is going to be quieted. I read you this give and take that I had with Hamza Yusuf to show you that you're so far, we are so far from a solution to a problem of where the world is headed. One of its most respected leaders, meaning, imagine our most respected leader getting up and giving musr to our people. I'd like to believe that our people would listen. I'd like to believe if we had somebody right now we consider. You know, lahavdil, let's say Rav Yashiv got up and Rav Yashiv said, we need to stop doing X or Y. I'd like to believe that we'd work on that. We'd stop that. We'd make sure that with the Gedolim meeting together, we'd work on it in some area, some level. But in the Muslim world, there's a total denial of the violence that is paramount, of the terror that is paramount. And it's growing, and it's growing, and it's getting stronger. So this kina, a'eda adchug shamayim, asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu that my only way out of this is if I could step out of this world and up to shamayim. Because down here, we're finished. We're sitting ducks. We're mamish sitting ducks. Wherever we go, we are surrounded, we are trapped, we are in big trouble. Kina ches, a'eda adchug shamayim. We're up to Kina Tess. I noticed something. I've been watching, and everybody talks about how, you know, Europe is being lost, so to speak, to moderation. And I came upon this incidentally, and I find it fascinating. Because it really should not be. It has no reason to be. One country that has been great about resisting anti-Semitism has been Denmark and Scandinavia as a whole. For example, since the beginning of German occupation on April 9th, 1940, Denmark avoided all adoption of any anti-Jewish policies. They would not allow the Yellow Star. They would not allow the confiscation of businesses. There's a story that King Christian X, of the Danish king, rode daily on horseback wearing a Star of David to symbolize solidarity between Denmark and the Jewish people.
suddenly, I noticed something fascinating, a stream that's very interesting. In 2008, there was a massive anti-Israel march in Malmo, Sweden. That was the first time anything overtly anti-Israel or anti-Jewish had been done in these countries. But that's nothing. You know, a march is nothing. No harm, no foul. Now, what's changed is come to 2017. The ADL did a study that found that 74% of Scandinavians harbor anti-Semitic views. 74%. That's far higher than Germany or Poland. What distinguishes Scandinavian anti-Semitism from the European counterparts is that it's intensely anti-Zionist. What does that mean? The pro-Palestinian position, for example, of the Norwegian government further encourages direct relationship. Each time there is a growth in pro-Palestinian behavior, the amount of anti-Jewish sentiment grows each day. Governmental policy in Norway right now. The Norwegian government officially considers itself a broker in the Middle East peace process, but will never list Hamas as a terrorist organization and says that Hamas is a vital partner in the peace process. A Norwegian mayor said the following. Just because Hamas shoots rockets and fires on innocent civilians, that alone does not make one a terrorist. The local Chabad rabbi in Sweden, in Malmo, Sweden, says in the last 2 years he has recorded 90 anti-Semitic incidents. One of them, just recently, he said, the other week, was Palestine was scratched onto his car. Swedish media, one of the leading media figures in Sweden, his name is Mathan Ravid, says that the Israeli people are causing most of the oppression and chaos in the larger framework of the Middle East. It's unbelievable that somehow it is all turned. Copenhagen's mayor, Anna May Alserlev, right, said the following. Copenhagen's mayor. The Danish should not be involved in featuring any Israeli products whatsoever. Selling diverse foods and cultures of various nations should not include those of Israel. Okay. Who has taken the leading role in challenging the legitimacy of circumcision? None other than Denmark. In 2008, the National Children's Council led the proposal on a ban of circumcising all children under the age 15. The ban was never codified, but in May 2012, another attempt was made and will begin again this year. Another attempt will be made. Found another article about Sweden. The most sophisticated Swedish newspaper is Dagens Nyheter. Had a title of an article in op-ed, "It Should Be Allowed to Hate the Jews." Mamishu, it sounds like something we're reading from 1940. It should be allowed to hate the Jews. A festival in Oslo rejected the documentary called The Other Dreamers. The Other Dreamers is a movie about the lives of disabled children. Why was it rejected? Because it's an Israeli film and we support the cultural boycott of Israel, wrote Ketel Magnusson. So a film, nothing to do with Israel, just it's a film from Israel, it's an Israeli film, but it's about disabled children.
It's banned. Sweden's foreign minister, Margot Wallström, said in order to defeat Islamic aggression in our region, it's going to take Israel's surrender. Unbelievable. They have a problem with Islamic aggression. They have a problem with Islamic violence or refugee violence, whatever the context is in their country. The way to stop it is not to deal with programs within the country, social programming, or whatever else a country chooses to fix the problem of crime and poverty and everything else. But rather, the way to fix it is Israel must surrender their hold on territories. The epitome of anti-Semitism is that. Don't let anybody tell you that anti-Israel is separate from anti-Semitism. Could not have written it better. The city council of Trondheim, Norway's third largest city, this year passed a motion calling on its residents to boycott Israeli goods. We are a city that aspires to be Israel free. Shkoyach. Tromso, a population 72,000 of Norway, has a city council that is now forwarding the motion this week. It is going to vote where the Norwegians are going to boycott these products. What does Scandinavia have to do? Norway and Sweden, these were bastions of political neutrality, champions of multiculturalism. They were the most, according to Global Peace Index, the most peaceful countries in the world. But there is this dark secret. And I think it is important to bring out. How many Jews really live there now? But it's important to bring out. Because you could take a place that should on paper have no Jew hatred. It is the most peaceful place in the world. The people don't like, they are multicultural, they're diverse, they're open-minded. Their way of life is so open-minded. They've blurred the lines of male and female. They're so open-minded. You know, Swedish schools right now, plenty of Swedish schools right now got rid of a total gender neutrality in reference. No words like boy or girl. They're so modern, they're innovative, they're forward-thinking. Yet somehow the oldest pastime finds a way of creeping in no matter what. A people that should be celebrated or at least minimally ignored. Ignored. Norwegian universities all agreed together they would join forces in prohibiting, there's a ban in Norwegian universities that will not allow Alan Dershowitz to speak. Now there's not allowed to speak in any Norwegian university. A proposal for an academic boycott against Israel was proposed by Norway's University of Trondheim. You understand? The other universities don't boycott Israel. They boycott the areas that they believe are in question or Israel should back out of. A university boycott is the first of its kind. If it passes, the complete, you understand? The complete university is completely boycotting the entire country. If that would happen, that would be the first kind of it, the first of its kind in a university, a European university, since the Nazi boycott of Jewish professors. Norwegian Ministry of Finance has officially excluded all Israeli companies, like Africa Israel Investments, Danya Sibus, from its global pension fund. The Norwegian pension fund that invests in national wealth and foreign stocks could not have anything Israeli inside of it. You think the business sector would be oblivious to this garbage? Not the business sector. What about the intellectual sector? Johan Galtung, Norwegian sociologist. Looked him up in Wikipedia. You know what he's called? He's called the father of peace studies. The father of peace studies. Shalom. This is the master of Shalom. Right? So he said as follows. Look what he writes. He says, the main impediment to peace in the world right now are the people of Israel. This is the father of peace. This is the author, the architect of Shalom in the modern world. In the modern world. Evelyn Zera, who works at Hadassah Hospital, she's the head researcher at Hadassah Hospital. You know, one area that usually is untouched by hatred is the realm of refuah, taking care of people who are sick. When someone is dying, you help them. You help them. No matter what culture, no matter what country, they need your help, you help them. Evelyn Zera works at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, asked a Norwegian researcher, Ingrid Harbitz, to send her material to develop treatment, right, for those suffering from thalassemia. Thalassemia is a blood disease which predominantly affects Palestinians. So this was a Jewish research doctor in Hadassah Hospital who needed assistance so she could help mainly Palestinian victims in Israel. And the response was, due to the current situation in the Middle East, I will not deliver material to Israeli universities. I will not deliver material to Israeli universities. The Daily Aftenposten, which was Norway's number one newspaper, its most famous writer is Jostein Gaarder. He says the following: it's time that we no longer recognize the state of Israel. That sounds like an Iranian imam, something like that. It's come the time to no longer recognize the state of Israel. Swedish parliament a few days ago discussed a deal between Volvo, country's most important car maker, and the Israeli bus companies. Okay? The deal was that it was going to involve, right, keep Volvo, by the way, provides some of the buses which keep the Israelis safe in Judea and Samaria. But according to the chairman of Sweden's Parliamentary Committee on Foreign Affairs, the providing of Volvo buses to keep Israelis alive is a violation of international law. You understand this? Volvo has been providing buses to keep children safe so that people are throwing stones, throwing rocks, or worse stuff into these buses. So the Swedish government parliamentary committee said Volvo has to stop doing that because it's a violation of international committee. You know how many Swedish ships saved the Jews from Nazis? Those days are long gone. Those days are long gone. And my focusing on the hatred of Sweden to the Jews is if a country that focuses on its peaceful nature, its peaceful behavior, on staying out of everything, Denmark, Sweden have been so able to stay out of all messes, has somehow found its way to being one of the most anti-Semitic countries right now in the world, you can be sure that the countries that are more prone to it will be there very shortly as well. Eicha tifarti marosh asai hishlichu chenecha chisekha. That's why the Kohanim are able to bless in this Kina, the 10th Kina, they're able to bless the people with Shalom when they give the Birkas Kohanim. It's because, oh, if Shalom, Verod if Shalom. That was the Midah of Aaron HaKohen. So the Gemara in Megillah, Chafav HaMebeis, talks about the different situations in where the Kedusha of a Beis HaKnesses can expire. So the Gemara says the following about a case of a sale. So it's talking about a Beis Knesset that was given as a gift. Rav Acha and Ravina have a machlokas. One says it's usher to use it for divrei chol, and Ravina says it's mutter. So what's the machlokas all about? Right, it's a Beis Knesset that was given as a matana, as a gift. It's not a sale. It's a matana. So what's the machlokas all about? Simple pshat is the machlokas all about is, does the kedusha Beis Knesses go away only when the congregation gets something in exchange for the synagogue, or does the act of disowning the synagogue suffice enough? Understand? my relinquishing ownership over the synagogue, is that enough to be able to undo the Kedusha? Or must there be an exchange? So the Gemara says, the one who said it was Aser said, because you have nothing to transfer the Kedusha. There's no Chalipin. While the one who allowed it says that if the giver didn't get some benefit from it, he wouldn't have given it. So that's already the barter. Meaning, the Gemara assumes what? Right? You heard that other svar? Let me say that svar again. Why does one opinion allow it without a barter? Because the other opinion says there is a barter. Whenever there is a gift, you're gaining from that gift. There's an exchange. There's a hana. There's an exchange. Therefore, since there was an exchange, there was a transference, it's going to be, the Kedusha will leave. The Gemara is assuming that people don't just give gifts freely. People expect to get something in return. It's a very cynical view of human nature, that everything is based on an interest. And the Gemara doesn't give you an alternative view, that anyone who gives something as a matana is expecting to get some hanof from it, something back in return. Rambam calls this a ava shetluya ledavar, we know from Pirkei Avos, but it means, he calls it a utilitarian love, a love where I get something back, I get a value. The Gemara in Gittin, give you another example, Nunam Abeis. There it's a different machlokas altogether. The Mishnah says that payment can't be claimed back from stuff that has a shibud, mortgaged property, when there's free assets available, when there are b'nei chorin, when there's free assets available. If the borrower has assets that have been sold to another party, but he also has free assets, the lender can't get his debt from the stuff that he mortgaged in the hands of the buyer. So what about assets that were given away as a gift instead of sold? Right? What if I gave away something to somebody else? I didn't sell it. I gave it away. And now you want to come collect from me. Can you go get that stuff from that guy if it was not sold to him, but if it was given to him? So the Gemara says, do we say even in the case of a gift? Because the Lil Leis Behana, since he did not get some benefit, maybe he wouldn't have given it. It's the same Yesod. He never would have given it as a gift if he didn't get something from it over here. The Gemara understands that a gift operates in the same way that the Gemara in Megillah does. A gift doesn't just come from goodness of the heart, but also self-interest. Why am I sharing with this here? Because I want to raise the question of whether it's possible to give a gift that is given absolutely freely. During the 3 weeks, this time period, we're remembering the horrible destruction that befell the Jewish people 2,000 years ago. What are the causes that led up to the destruction? So Chazal make a chilik between the causes that led up to the first Beis HaMikdash and those that led up to the second Beis HaMikdash. There are accounts of the first Beis HaMikdash, even though there were ups and downs, but the overall picture is very gloomy. The problems of the first Beis HaMikdash were Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. You could open up Yeshaya and Yirmiyah to see the full picture. The second Beis HaMikdash has a different picture. The second Beis HaMikdash is where you see that the beginning of real Limud HaTorah, the idea of a shul begins to emerge, but you see that people are generally committed during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash was a bloodbath, Avodah Zarah, everything. Second, you have frum Jews. You have Torah mitzvahs, you have tefillah. Things are growing. So that's why Chazal said, to figure out why the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, you're going to have to look somewhere else. You're going to have to find something else, because it's not Gilui Arayos and Avodah Zarah. These are frum people here. It's a frum generation. So Chazal found something during that time period. Two words that Jews will never forget. Sinas chinam. Baseless hatred. I understand sinas chinam is not a good thing. But why is it so chamor that it brought about the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash? There's an iser al tisnet achicha belecha, don't hate your brother in your heart. Okay, but there are many prohibitions. Why is that one so severe? And Rabbeinu Yonah himself writes in Shari Tshuva that a negative commandment that does not involve in action, alav she'ein b'maisa, is much less severe than a negative commandment that has an action. Hating someone in your heart has no action. It's less severe. What do? So it might be true that on the scale of sins and transgressions, you're right. Sin is chinam is going to lose. There are things you could do with your hands that are much worse, actively. There's no specific prohibition you could point to of sin is chinam. You just are not allowed to hate. But the Gemara said, and by the way, if you notice in the Al Chait of Yom Kippur, there's a difference between when you clap Al Chait between Sinna and Sinas Chinam. Two separate categories. Hatred and baseless hatred. So let me quote you the Rambam, and maybe we could understand what Sinas Chinam is and why it's so powerful. Says the Rambam in Hilchas Tshuva, a person shouldn't think that tshuva is only necessary for those sins that involve things such as being, inappropriate, gilui arayos, or stealing, or robbing. Rather, just as you have to do tshuva from those, similarly, you have to search out all your bad midos. Meaning, tshuva is not just tshuva from bad behaviors, actions. Tshuva, according to the Rambam, is also from midos. You have to repent from anger, hatred, envy, pursuit of money and honor. You have to repent from all of those. And says the Rambam, Kashin divre'elu, these averis are more difficult than those averis that actually have deeds. Why? Because these, they become attached to you. They stick to you. They're very hard for you to separate yourself from those kinds of behaviors. So when the Rambam writes that these averis are more difficult, he doesn't mean in terms of the severity of the prohibition. Yeah, eina chenami, a lav sheyesh b'maisa, a lav that has an action is more severe. But he's referring to the influence that it has on the person. If we ask ourselves, what's the place of sinas chinam? Right? It's a negative commandment. But it wasn't the transgression and its chumrah that brought Chazal to say that sin is chinam was the cause of the Beis HaMikdash. But rather, it was the impact on the individual and the nation. You hear the chiluk we're making here? It's not because if you calculate which points are the worst from which sins. Right? Everybody talks about, oh, I knew that guy who did the worst sin on Yom Kippur. You know what he did? And everyone has the story of who did the worst avera. Sin is chinam would lose in a battle, in a Vera battle, in terms of points. But in terms of impact among the person, impact among the nation, sin is chinam is the worst. Why? Why does sin is chinam stick like glue to our personality? Now we go back to the beginning of what I said over here. What does sin is chinam mean? Does a person wake up in the morning and decide for no reason that he can't stand his neighbor? You don't wake up and for no reason in the morning, right, you're annoyed. Ah, I just don't like my neighbor. If some ulterior motive, as we saw in the Gemara Megillah and the Gemara Megittin, if some ulterior motive is motivating unwarranted gifts and unwarranted love, then there has to be some reason behind unwarranted hatred. You understand? We said in the Gemara in Gittin and Megillah that giving away a shul or giving away a gift has to come with some motivation. You have to say the opposite as well. Hatred just doesn't come from nowhere. There's no such thing as really baseless. It just seems baseless. So what level as a person need to reach in order to have sinas chinam? It's because of a lack of sensitivity. It's because of a contempt for all things that are kadosh, that are holy. And it sticks to you so much so that it seems baseless. That's the vort in sinas chinam. The pshat in sinas chinam is not baseless hatred. It's the wrong translation. It should be things that seem baseless. Because the Gemara is telling us there is no emotion that does not come with some opposite effect. And therefore your hatred must come because something deep inside you has a disdain for the other person and you're ignoring it instead of working on it. And that's what happened in the time of Chazal. It has such an impact on everybody around you. The Gemara says, the world stands, ha'olam almeid, the world stands on three foundations, Torah, Avoda, and Gemilus Chasadim. When you take away one of those foundations, the world falls apart. You know what that means? I saw a vort from Rav Chaim Shmulevitz on the flood. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, Yadua mebalei musar. It's known from the balei musar that the flood was not a punishment. It was a result. Why? Because of the chamas that they've done to each other, the world just collapsed. Couldn't stay up anymore. Imagine chesed as one of the things, olam chesed yibane, chesed's holding up the world. All of a sudden people started cutting off the legs of chesed, it couldn't hold anymore. And the world just fell down. It was a consequence. I think the same vort here is what we're saying when it comes to sin as chinam. The Beis HaMikdash just fell. It could not stand anymore. It had no ability, it had no kiyam, it had no ability to stand because the world stands on Torah, Avoda, Gemilus, Chasadim. If you don't have one, the whole thing falls apart. The whole thing falls apart. Rambam in Hilchas Tanias tells us that it's a mitzvah to cry out and blow the trumpets in the time of any Eis Tzara. Any Eis Tzara. Because an Eis Tzara is a time of returning to Hashem, of tshuva and introspection, and figuring out where we stand and working on our midas. Rambam Hilchas Tanias, Perek Aleph. He emphasizes 2 points. Rambam, number one, I spoke about this on Shabbos afternoon. Number one, the recognition that the troubles that happen to us is because we're lost in sin. And number two, the obligation to locate our failing and that which needs fixing. So fast days were instituted for a way for us to introspect. That's why I say, the idea of sleeping off the fast day is not really the point of a fast day. The point of a fast day is to do the tshuva and to have the introspection to look and figure out what went wrong. So first and foremost, you have to examine your behaviors. What actions you do that are bad. Number two, the introspection and what you call soul searching to figure out what you should have done and what you should not have done. But the third layer is what are the roots that caused this in the first place? What do I have in me? What flaw led me down this road? How did I get here? Where did this come from at its core? Where did this come from? And that's what sinas chinam is about. Sinas chinam is about the people had gotten to a place where they stopped noticing. The Mesilas Yesharim in his introduction says, I'm not here to say anything you don't already know, but to review the things you've learned already, but we forget them. What are those things? The things of how to act. The Mesilas Yesharim says, what's a chassid? What's a chassid? I remember once I was getting really into chassid. I'm very into chassid. See over here, I love chassidus. But I wanted to become a real chassid. So I went to Rav Moshe Weinberger from the Eish Kodesh in Woodmere. So I figured he'd be the right guy to go to. He went to YU and then he became a chassid. Same path I'm looking at. So I went to Rav Weinberger and said, how do I become a chassid? So he said, great, I'm excited you're joining the force. I'm going to give you a bunch of svarim to look at. He gave me Bilvavi Vishkan Evna Chelik Beis. He gave me passages in the Avodas Koshnitzer and the Koshnitzer. And I'm going through everything, and I'm waiting to find the page where it tells me, you know, when you're supposed to wear the shtrimal, when you wear this. I don't know when to put the bekesher on, when not to put it on. So I'm, where do you look? Where do you get that stuff? So I thought one of the pages should have it already. I'm going to the svarim and I'm reading. I'm like, he must have given me the wrong. I went back to him. He said, you know what? Maybe I gave you wrong stuff. Let me give you another list. He gave me another list, 10, 12 more svarim to look at. And I'm looking through it. And nothing. It doesn't tell me how I get the payas to curl. I don't know how to do anything. And all of a sudden, I go back to Rav Weinberger and I say, I chopped it. I got it. I understand what you're trying to tell me.
What it means to be a chassid means to work on your midos. It means to be a good and decent person. It means to not take for granted that your midos are there, that your qualities are there. And everything will go well. And everything will go well. And that you have a positive outlook and that you work on taking care of other people and you get to the root of why bad midos actually happen, which is what the point of Mesilas Yesharim actually is. Mesilas Yesharim says, that's what a chassid, that's what a real chassid is, to get to the root of the problem. To get to the root of the problem. How does it appear and how does the problem appear? Let's begin. Eicha Yasha Yishuv HaChatzelos Hasharim.